it was tricky, and it nearly failed, and then it started raining, and everything that possibly could go wrong went wrong. But at the end, they managed to get it driving. Not fast, not Bugatti fast, but they had it driving, and then they did a film about it as well. So you should definitely check out the film. It's an awesome, insane project.
Welcome to the Nomad Podcast, where we discuss inspiring stories of lifestyle transition and how to thrive in a location-independent existence. Nomad Podcast is supported in part by Nomad Prep, an online academy to help aspiring digital nomads make a successful transition. And now, here's your host, Sean Tierney.
Palette Beau may be a late bloomer when it comes to starting his nomadic journey, but he is now channeling a career's worth of experience in radio into a unique project. At age 50, he left his small town in Denmark and set out to travel the world one country at a time, documenting his experiences via his project, Radio Vagabond. He has now been to over 80 countries and counting. In this interview, we discuss Pale's entrepreneurial journey and how he came to co-own 17 radio stations, his consulting business working with big brands like Bugatti and Lego, his artisan approach to podcasting, and more. Before we dig into this conversation, please enjoy a quick word from our sponsor. It's important to have travel insurance as a nomad because stuff happens while we're on the road. And while we hope for the best, we need to always plan for the worst. If you're investigating insurance options, check out Safety Wing. Safety Wing is travel medical insurance specifically designed for nomads. Unlike other providers, you can buy it when you're already on the road and you don't need to continuously update them on when and where you're going next. You just have one monthly subscription that covers you wherever you go for both travel and medical. And if you shop around, you'll find it's about a third of the price of other providers. Visit nomadpodcast.com/safetywing to get a quote today. And now here's the interview. All right, welcome everybody to the podcast. I'm your host, Sean Tierney, and I'm here today sitting across from Pale Beau. Pale is founder, owner, and CEO of Radio Guru, a production and consultant company where he develops radio campaigns, runs courses and workshops for radio stations, and does lectures on podcasting and creativity. Radio Guru won the Danish Pre-Radio Awards 5 times between 2010 and 2015. They were a finalist in the Cannes Lion 2011 and won the prestigious National Creative Circle Awards in both 2012 and 2019. Pale is co-owner of 17 radio stations in his home country of Denmark. And in July 2016, he started his life as a digital nomad, selling his house, car, and furniture and setting out to do a quest around the world to visit every country in the world. And the plan is to continue traveling nonstop for the next 10 to 15 years. Willkommen, Pale.
Tak.
Did I say that right?
Almost, yeah.
I don't know what's German or Danish or anything anymore. It sounds...
Yeah, willkommen. Yeah. You didn't say willkommen.
We'll go with it.
That was good. I'm impressed.
So let's start with the radio stations. You have had a long, illustrious career in radio. Can you just kind of take us back to, like, how does one come to co-own 17 radio stations?
Well, it did not start out like that. Not in a long shot. No, it was when I got into radio as a hobby in '85, back in the day when everything was black and white, and we were at this communal radio station where there were all kinds of programs going in all kinds of different directions, and it were a lot of political programs. Then a fiddler came in and did a program about traditional Danish fiddling music, and somebody did something about with country music, and then there were housewives coming in, and not to say anything bad about that. And then there were me and a bunch of other young guys who just enjoyed Stock Aitken Waterman pop music and wanted to do a pop radio. And it was not good. So at some point, me and another of the co-founders looked at each other and said, hey, do you want to start a radio station? And then we got two more on board. And it wasn't because we wanted to build a company. It was more like we wanted to make the kind of radio stations that we wanted to listen to, and maybe our friends wanted to listen to, and that was about it. So for a few years, it was still a hobby project. The station only had a few hours of broadcast, so we were able to do our regular day job in the day and then go and do some broadcasting at night. And yeah, it was just a fun hobby. And then it grew from there. And lo and behold, so many years later, we have 17 local regional stations in the country. And now it is a company. And yeah.
So with no background, you just basically, you guys kind of banded together and decided to just buy a radio station and start broadcasting?
No, we applied for a license and got that. And I like so many other people, I had a mobile discotheque. So I was getting into the whole playing music and just talking into a microphone. And I just thought it was so fascinating. And it was really my passion. I lived and breathed radio. I was thinking about it constantly. And I think that's also one of the reasons, because I was working as a graphic designer at the time. I think that was one of the reasons, because I was so focused on radio that they eventually fired me. They said, oh, we're restructuring the company and there's just no room for you now. But I think that was a lot of it had to do with that they could feel that my passion was more into radio there.
Interestingly enough, I just left my job last week of 5 years to pursue my passion as well. It's charity makeover, just a little side project that I started that I just kind of realized 5 years into it that like this is where my heart is now. And so, yeah. But I think it's kind of a blessing in disguise when these things kind of nudge you out of the nest.
I can't wait to hear more about that. And on that note, I'll be interviewing you on my podcast, but we'll get into that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm looking forward to it. So with the radio station, so this is still running. Is this what funds you at this point or
no.
is no.
So
no,
it gives me I own 10% of the company now, and it gives me a little passive income every year, which is nice. But for me, it's more like it's my retirement fund. It's worth some money, and maybe at some point we decide to sell the company. We're all about the same age, so I can easily see that in 10, 15 years we might want to find a buyer for the company and pass it on to the next generation, and then I will have a little coin for my retirement, because I'm not saving up for that.
Yeah.
if not, I'm going to die with a microphone in my hand and do the microphone drop.
Somewhere in one of the many countries in this world,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So what was it that inspired you to go nomadic in 2016?
It was actually, I'd lived in Denmark all my life in the same rural, not in Copenhagen, in a rural part of Denmark for 50 years, and I could see that in a few years both my daughters would have grown up and graduated and would probably move out of the house. So I was sort of toying with the idea maybe I should go and live a couple of years abroad. So I was playing with that idea, and in 2013 I went to Cape Town because I thought that might be the place. They are very much into radio. They do great radio, and especially radio advertising. They're really, really good at that. And so I went there to feel what that was like. When I was still living in Denmark, I said, no, I'm going 2 months. And that was in 2013, and that's where I realized that my clients, which at that point were mainly Danish agencies and brands, they didn't care where I was. And I thought, oh, I could work anywhere. So I thought, there are so many places I want to see, so why not just live out of the suitcase and do that? And then the whole idea grew from that. I was still thinking I'd be traveling for 2 years, but now I'm 3.5, almost 4 years in, and I'm still enjoying every single day. I have no plans of quitting anytime soon.
What was that like? Because I think everyone who does this comes to a point where you kind of have to acknowledge that, yeah, this is real. Like, I'm actually selling all my stuff and I'm now buying a plane ticket and I'm packing, you know, closing the door for the last time on this place. What was that like?
That was scary. That was so scary. Well, I was very public about the plan for a long time. I was talking about it on Facebook that in the summer of 2016 I'm going traveling, and now I'm selling my house, and now I'm selling my furniture, and come to my garage sale, and I posted plans of where I would go, and talked a lot about it. So I actually met a lot of people 6 months before I left, and I thought you were traveling. But that was something I did because it was part of me getting ready for it, and putting a commitment in there that I said it out loud and publicly, and then everything was fine, and I sold my house, and then I started selling my furniture before I had to hand over the keys. And I remember a couple of months before I had to leave, I was in my living room, and the room was getting more and more empty, so more and more echo. And I thought, what the hell am I doing? Because I was crossing the point of no return.
Yeah.
I thought, is this a mistake? At that point, I did not want to go anywhere. I just wanted to be in my own house, in my own couch, watching Netflix and not go anywhere. But then I left the house, had one more month, so I stayed at my parents' house that was empty at the time, and ever since the day I left, I haven't looked back. It's the best decision I ever made, but I was going out of the comfort zone, and that was scary.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very resonates with me. I did the same thing with Remote Year. Packed up everything, put it in storage. Didn't actually sell it, but like subsequently sold it. But yeah, I just remember leaving like that last time when you lock your apartment. You're like, I'm not coming back to this place and potentially this country ever again. Like, this is really weird.
Yeah.
So, cool. Let's talk about some of the companies you've worked with. You've done some really big projects. Can you maybe mention the Lego stuff or anything that you're comfortable talking about there?
Yeah, I'm working on a new project for Lego right now that I can't talk about, obviously. But in 2018, I did the Lego Technique podcast when they were making an ultimate project. They did a model of the Bugatti Chiron, the at that time the fastest and most expensive supercar in the world, and they wanted to. It's something that would take their customers weeks to assemble. It's very complicated, so they wanted to put an extra layer to the building experience, saying, hey, why don't we do a podcast? And then I was in Denmark visiting Lego and going into the secret rooms behind closed doors where they have a ton of grown-ups, and I like to tease them and say, here you are playing with Lego, and they just look at me and say, be careful what you say, we're designers. Oh, sorry. Where they were making this, and then I also went to Molsheim in France at the Bugatti factory, a small plant. They only did 500 of the Bugatti Chiron, and also to Wolfsburg in Germany, where they have a test track, and they do the engine there, and it's part of the Volkswagen group. So I was following that. So one episode is about the engine. So I speak to the Dutch guy who did the real engine and developed this special system where it can go super fast. And then I spoke to the designer at the Lego at Lego about how he recreated it. So one episode is about the engine, but there's one about the design and one about the special features and all that.
So this thing is functional. You can actually drive the.
No, this one was a 1-to-8 scale model.
Okay.
I also got to drive it, so that was awesome, or sit beside the driver going super, super fast. But then they decided to do a crazy, insane project where they did a 1-to-1 scale model of the Bugatti Chiron, really, truly 1-to-1 scale. And so I went to Kladno in the Czech Republic, just outside of Prague, where they have a plant where they do the big scale model for all the flagship stores and Legoland parks around the world. And they decided to recreate this also in Lego Technique, these tiny, tiny bricks, not using glue, And the most crazy thing was they wanted it to drive as well using only the tiny Lego Technique power function motors.
I mean, so, my Legos used to break. Forget driving; like I just playing with them, holding them in my hand. I can't imagine driving a car made of Legos.
It was crazy. So they did that, and then they transported it back to Wolfsburg, where they have the official test track and the longest piece of straight road anywhere in Europe, in a closed area. They had this side by side with the original, and it was awesome, and they actually made it drive. So I was following that process, being in Denmark and Czech Republic, and then finally in Wolfsburg. But imagine having moved it with the shaking and anything gone loose on that. So that, it was tricky, and it nearly failed, and then it started raining, and everything that possibly could go wrong went wrong. But at the end, they managed to get it driving. Not fast, not Bugatti fast, but they had it driving, and then they did a film about it as well. So you should definitely check out the film. It's an awesome, insane project. And when they did that, they decided to do a second season. So we did 3 episodes about the 1-to-1 scale model.
Cool. Yeah, I was such a Lego freak growing up. I had,
like all of us.
Yeah, but I mean, ask my parents, like my room was covered those little boards. You'd have like the space Legos, and I probably had like 40 of these things all stitched together with bases and whatnot.
But I tell you what was in episode 1, we were talking about the history of the two companies, and a Lego historian in Denmark took me down to what they call the vault. It's something that's not open for the public. It's in the basement in one of their buildings, and they have a lot of shelves where they stick us on with years of when the products came out, and then they have all the products. So I could go back in time and then go back to when I was like 6-7 years old and see what was on the shelves, and it was just goosebumps, because I was there with a friend of mine who works at Lego, one of the creative directors, and we were about the same age, and when we came to that shelf, he started crying. He said, "I've never been here before. This is just amazing. I feel like I'm 7 years old again." You would enjoy that.
Man, I wrote a blog post on my dad's blog for Father's Day maybe 2 years ago about this experience. And you know how like there throughout your life you can kind of name the 2 or 3 like very crossroad moments that kind of develop you, mm-hmm. or you know, make you into what you are. I had this experience. I remember building a Lego, the most complex thing I'd ever built. It was called the Galaxy Explorer. It was this massive space one. And I remember that I got close, but that just, it didn't have the right pieces. And I'm following the instructions, and like, as a very analytical, like nerd kid, you know, I was very like precise, and I couldn't build this thing because it didn't have the right pieces. And I just remember like just sobbing and going to my father and being like, "I can't do it. It's just not possible. Like, they didn't give me the right pieces." And him saying, "You know, that's just a suggestion of how you can build it. Like, you can probably build a better one." And it was like that license to just create and go outside the lines. And that was just, that moment was such one of those like, oh, I don't have to build what the instructions tell me to build.
What a great answer.
Yeah. It's just...
Yeah, and I think that's something that's is so unique about Lego, that it inspires people to be super creative. And I got to learn a lot about the company since I've been working with them, and they have a lot of hardcore fans sending in suggestions and building stuff, and they end up hiring a lot of them as well. And for those people, it's a dream job.
I haven't followed since they added. I know they have now like robotics and mechanics, like the mech stuff. But so I know it's come a long way since the old days. Like the ones that I played with were just, you know, little plastic pieces that fit together. But still, just like imagination expanding. Like, oh wow, you can create anything. Like,
yeah.
Cool. Okay. Well, I was going to ask you how your radio career, so you're now podcasting The Vagabond. Can you talk about what The Vagabond Radio is? What the theme of that show is?
And I want to take a second to briefly pause here and tell you about an exciting project that I'm working on. I recently left my job of 5 years to go full-time on a side project that I started called Charity Makeover. This is a hackathon that brings volunteer knowledge workers together to build game-changing digital assets for local charities in a single day. Think of it like a Habitat for Humanity, only with virtual assets instead of physical houses.
I recently deployed a platform that enables anyone to bring this movement to his or her city. If you think you might be interested in being the admin for your city, visit charitymakeover.org/podcast to learn more. And now back to the interview.
Yeah, the Radio Vagabond is a podcast about my journey. I started in radio and audio production because it's my passion, and it's still my passion and still my hobby. And I just started it, I think, mostly for myself when I'm 95 years old and probably not traveling so much anymore. It's my memories. It's my photo album. I record all the time and record on street corners and talk to people I meet, and Uber drivers and tour guides, and try to get a sense of the place I'm in. And it also gives me an excuse to talk to people and meet people. So I really enjoy doing it, even though it takes a hell of a long time. I just published an episode today that took me most of a week of just editing, which is insane for a 30-minute episode. And
You put extraordinary production quality into your episodes. Like, you're doing what I would consider like NPR level, like, very like art for art's sake, a lot of edits and stuff in there.
Yeah, that's what I try to do. Thank you so much for saying so. Yeah, it is a lot of work, but I can't not do it. I have to.
yeah. Well, I listened to the Becky Gillespie episode, you'll be happy to know, on 1x, not my normal 1.7x, because I know that you said it was like, it's about like, you know, a painter, like, if you, I don't know, if you look at their painting through sunglasses or something.
Yeah, I had a friend of mine, even a friend of mine, I'd like to say a former friend of mine, say that he always listens to my podcast in double speed. And I said, no. Yeah, but it saves me time. Yeah, but do you listen to music in double speed? It will save you a couple of minutes every time you hear a song.
Yeah.
It's not the same, but for me it is. So if you listen to my podcast in double speed, please just don't tell me if you want to maintain the relationship.
Yours is the only one overcast that's
at
1x.
I'm doing it the way it's supposed to be.
Fair enough. How has your career in radio mapped over to podcasting? Like, what did you take from that experience, and how has it helped?
Oh, a lot. For me, it's just the platform it comes out on. I try to do the same kind of work that I did when I was on the radio, even though I didn't do much of this montage editing when I was in radio. But even though it's quite different, having worked with radio advertising and have to create small 30 or 60 second audio theater, it has given me a lot in terms of radio drama and how I put things together, and sound effects should be there but not too much, and the way I use music and stuff like that. So it's given me a lot in that sense. But for me, it could be on the radio, and in fact it also is. It's a part of the programming on a station in London called Podcast Radio. So shout out to those guys. So I'm actually on the air in London and that area and online. And I used to do also a shorter version of the Radio Vagabond for National Danish Radio. In the first part of my journey, until they ran out of money because of budget cuts. For me it's still radio, it's still audio, and it just happens to be available as a podcast.
Yeah, for sure. I remember when we were in Dubai dune bashing, and you guys get a flat tire, and we're driving up behind you, and Pale is sitting out there next to the guy changing the tire with the recorder, like recording an interview with him, right?
Yeah, it's just, obviously. Yeah, we were dune bashing, and you were in another car, and I tried to record inside the car as we were driving nuts. But it was a lot of fun. So there's probably I haven't even started listening to it yet. But then we had a flat tire after we went out onto the regular road, and yeah, I think that it's always an interesting story when something goes wrong. So that's something I try to appreciate. Whenever something goes wrong or I get scammed, I think, oh, at least I have a good story for the podcast.
Well, I love the saying, bad decisions make great stories.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Can you talk about that train? So that's another one that I was listening to on your show, was that that Sri Lankan train, which was fascinating because you're interviewing the guy with the block and how they, you know, make the train, like this very old school method that they have for ensuring that the train can't possibly ever be like, have a head-on collision with another train.
Yeah.
Like what, so just maybe tell people about that experience. I mean, that sounded like a really cool.
Yeah, it was super cool. Also, I was on a 10-day press trip to Sri Lanka, invited by Sri Lanka Tourism because of the podcast. So it doesn't give me a lot of money to do the podcast, but it does give me press trips here and there. And yeah. And one of the things we did was to go on this scenic train ride in the center of the island through some of the most amazing landscapes. And we started out at on this train station in Kandy in Sri Lanka, where they have this old school system that the British brought there a long time ago, and they changed it in Britain, but not in Sri Lanka. So it just it still works. And I one of the other bloggers is an English guy who knew a lot about it. So I spoke to Travel Dave about this and how the whole system worked, and it was fascinating to watch it, kind of like a time capsule. And then we went on the train, which was stunning. They say it's one of the most scenic train rides in the world, and I could totally see why. We go through this beautiful landscape, and there are no doors in the train, so obviously we had to hang out of the doors, which was probably not the safest thing to do. But
there's a picture of you hanging off the side of it.
Yeah, we had to get that Instagram moment. Well, yeah,
right.
And if I'd fallen off, that would make a great story.
Yeah, we will link to that episode because that was a particularly good one, and there's some amazing photos from that. Very cool. Okay, well let's shift gears. You and I met via the Nomad Cruise, and a mutual friend, Matt Bowles. Shout out to Matt, who has his own podcast. You've been on it. I've been on it. He's been.
You've been on it twice, so I'm a little bit jealous.
Technically, Matt. Three times. He Damn. Reused one of my episodes as me as being the host for him. No, but like. So Matt introduced us. I'll never forget. We were in, I think it was Porto Galinhas in Brazil, and you're standing there with a recorder. You just brought it out with you. We're kind of out in the streets, and you're...
Yeah, but when we met in Porto Galinhas, that was after Nomad Cruise 7, and you weren't
Which
on
I was
that.
Not on, yeah.
You were not on that.
Well, I was not a stowaway, but I don't know what you call it. I flew to where the cruise docked, and then I kind of... Everyone got off, and they thought I was just part of it because there was so many people on it. So kind of blended in, and that's where I realized, like, oh, there's a really good group of people. I think I want to do this myself.
Yeah, yeah. And I was kind of thinking, I don't remember seeing him, but then again, we were 500 nomads on the ship, so...
Plausible deniability. Yeah. What were your thoughts on the cruise? Because you've been on a couple of them.
Yeah, I went on 6 and 7, and then we were both on Nomad Cruise 10.
Yeah.
I just love it, and I'm going to keep coming back. And I love the community, and it so happens right now we're in Canggu, Bali, and I think we're around 50 Nomad Cruises here right now.
Yeah.
So we've had a few meetups, and it's been super, super nice. And I feel like I have... I become part of a family, and I really, really, really enjoy that, and part of that community. And when you're in the alumni, there's always a good chance that there are somebody where you are, and through their Facebook page, you can always post. I'm here now. Anybody here? And I haven't done remote the year and Wi-Fi tribe that you and Matt has, but. I could see myself doing something similar because I enjoy being a solo traveler. It's nice to have a community here and there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I always think of it like it's great to you can be in one of these travel groups and go solo and go off on your own, and that's totally fine. But then you always have something to come back to if you choose to. But you can't really do the reverse. When you're just going by yourself, you can't manifest a giant community instantly and have that kind of safe base to come back to. So
no, you can go to co-work spaces and stuff like that, but it's different. It's different. Also, I try to go to a lot of travel blogger or travel content creator conferences. I've been to Traverse in Europe and TravelCon in the U.S. and also TBEX. I also produce the TBEX podcast. So there, it's kind of the same. You meet my people, but it's different when it's a conference on land than when it's a conference on a ship, because you're stuck on that boat. And you eat together, you drink together, you dance together, you do all kinds of meetups, and you really become bonded in a totally different way when you're on a ship. So yeah, that's one of the reasons I really love it and keep coming back.
I agree wholeheartedly. That captive audience thing, there's just something special about it's like no other conference that I've been to in that regard.
So did the Nomad Cruise 10 live up to your expectations?
Yeah, I really liked it. It was much different than, because I'd only been on Nomad Cruise 8 before that, which was like a 6-day cruise. So this was a 17-day, so very different.
Oh, yeah.
But far more sustainable pace, in my opinion. Like, because the other one was so short, it was just like go, 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 go.
Yeah.
And I just remember just feeling so just depleted after that one.
Yeah.
Whereas 10 was like the right pace. It was kind of slow and steady.
I think that's one of the reasons I decided to skip Nomad Cruise 8, because I thought, we're going to be in land almost every day. And that's going to be nice and exciting. But what I value the most is the time and the community on the boat where we're...
Yeah, the sea days.
Just the sea days where we're just stuck there.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. Cool. Well, yeah, I definitely highly recommend Wi-Fi Tribe. Remote Year was awesome. I think they're kind of changing now a bit. That's a whole nother discussion. But highly recommend checking out Wi-Fi Tribe. And can you talk about how did these deals, so the Sri Lanka deal, how do those things come to fruition? Do they contact you, or are you out there pinging the different convention visitor bureaus, or how does that work?
It varies. It's all through networking and the travel conferences I've been to. When I was invited to go to Antigua and Barbuda, that came from Traverse Events, which is they do events in Europe. So I've been to their conference, also spoke about podcasting at one of them. And they were asked by Antigua and Barbuda Tourism to get a great group of content creators together for a press trip. So that came totally out of the blue. I didn't see that coming, but that was really, really great. With Sri Lanka, I also at different conferences I've met the guys from Sri Lanka Tourism, so they got to see me as a familiar face. So when they were planning to bring a group to Sri Lanka, they asked me if I'd like to join. But I also go look for it. I go to WTM, World Travel Market, in London every year if I can. Mm-hmm. It's in November. And then I go to ITB in Berlin, where you get to meet I think at WTM there are about 5,000 travel brands and destinations. So you go around networking and pitching yourself and set up meetings and tell them who you are and what it is that you do, and then they will hopefully come back to you. Mm-hmm. And say that they're inviting you on a trip somewhere, and there's a big debate in the travel bloggers community. I'm calling it travel bloggers, even though it can be YouTubers and Instagrammers and podcasters like me, but just in lack of a better word.
You're an influencer now.
We don't use the word influencer. It's got a bad ring. But content creators. Where was I? no, there's a big debate among these people that should we get paid as well and not just create content for a free trip. It's something that's hard to balance, because I see it. Obviously we should get paid for good quality work, because I spend a lot of time working on what I do, and it is my profession. But at the same time, I wanted to go to Antigua, I wanted to go to Sri Lanka, and they pay all expenses. I didn't get paid for it, but they paid all expenses and took me on tours and really planned out. So not even the flights to and from. So I get to save a lot of money, because I wanted to go anyway. In that sense, I am getting paid.
What would be the argument against getting paid? I mean, to me, the market will dictate. Like, if what you're doing is valuable enough to them where they can justify paying you, then why wouldn't they?
Yeah, and that's the whole debate, because they would pay for an editorial in a newspaper or another medium, and there are just so many like me that would go on a free trip, it's also about how big you are. I don't know for sure, but I have a feeling that one or two of the Sri Lanka trip were paid as well. And maybe somebody from the Antigua trip were paid, and not just they were paid a salary, a fee for their work, but they're in a different level than my podcast is at the moment. So I'm considering that's totally fair. I just want, it gives me something to strive for and grow my audience and be even bigger, even though I am quite big, but not when you're talking YouTube subscriber numbers, and some of them are were really, really big. Yeah. And some have some really, really successful travel blogs.
I think there's a rule about disclosure. I don't recall what it is, but I think, like, if you're a blogger and you're receiving free stuff, you just have to disclose that it's being provided for free. But there's no rule against getting paid for your work. I feel like that's just your value.
I think then it's called a sponsored post. I think you still have to disclose it. Yeah. So I was very clear on this is paid for by Sri Lanka Tourism, but everything I say is totally my own genuine opinion. Yeah. And I was actually in one of the episodes, I'm actually quite critical about something with the elephants and riding elephants and struggling, should I say that, or am I offending them? But I wouldn't be true to myself if I just talked about it as if it was all good. I had to say that, and they totally respect that. I even went and did an interview with one of the guys from Sri Lanka Tourism about the whole thing and the difference in culture and the way it's done and all that. Yeah. So I am being myself, even though I get a paid trip.
Yeah. Yeah. Guest number four, a good friend of mine, Andrew Hyde, he actually got kicked out of Tibet for posting photos of the child labor on the roads. I guess there was, they really exploit children and they use them to build the roads there. And there's like casualties and stuff, and so he did a photo piece on it and was basically told, leave, you need to leave the country. And so that's episode four for anyone who wants to check that one out. It's a pretty amazing story. Wow.
Yeah, if that happened to me, I would start recording immediately as as I was about to be kicked out.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, and in full disclosure, Pali is paying me to be on this episode today. Cool. I think this is probably a good place to wrap up, but I do have a little kind of rapid fire round that we end with. So are you ready for the breakdown?
Oh, yeah.
Breakdown, baby.
All right, let's do it. What is one book that has profoundly affected you?
Vagabonding.
Yes, yeah. Ralph Potts.
Ralph Potts. And I actually had him. He obviously he inspired me for the name The Radio Vagabond, that yeah. book. And I bought the audiobook first. I'm more into audiobooks, but then I liked it so much I had to have the paper version as well to make small notes in. So I have both. And then I actually met Ralph Potts at one of the conferences I was attending in Austin, Texas, and had him on my show as well. So it was like awesome. Meeting my hero. Yeah, that's it's awesome. Awesome book.
Yeah, I read that one a number of years ago, about the time when I read the 4-Hour Workweek, because I know Tim Ferriss had cited that one as well as being a very impactful one.
Yeah, actually, Tim Ferriss was inspired by Vagabonding, not the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. No, that was the like a seminal work that then and the 4-Hour Workweek at this point, it's funny, that's what everyone knows, but if you trace it all the way back, Vagabonding is kind of like that.
Yeah, and actually, the audiobook of Vagabonding, Tim Ferriss, I think he produced it. His company produced it, and he did the foreword and the intro. So, yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Good choice. What about what is one person you'd love to have dinner with? Living or dead, doesn't matter.
Nelson Mandela. Yeah.
Cool. Why?
It might be one of the obvious choices, but I'm particularly fond of South Africa and the whole history of the country, and I've been to Robben Island twice, and so I just find the whole history of the company and of the country and what he did for the country so fascinating. So if I could go back in time and meet him, I would really, really enjoy that.
Cool. Good answer. What is one tool or hack that saves you time, money, or headaches?
I'm tempted to mention hotels25.com, but that would be probably where you ask me to for some money. Because
no, I mean, if it's a good service, I saw that you're repping that service, so maybe if talk about it. I mean,
yeah,
there's
probably
a reason you are.
It's a search site that searches a lot of the big hotel search sites, and like Agoda, hotels.com, and 15 others in one search, and compares the prices, so that works. And it's not only hotel rooms, it's also for hostels and guest houses and stuff like that. So that's a thing I use a lot. But I don't really know. Was it travel hacks that saves me money or
time, money, or headaches? Yeah.
I also when I search for flights, I use the simple Skyscanner, but I love the option that you can search from here to anywhere.
Yes.
Sometimes it's not the neighboring country that's the cheapest, and then I just, I haven't been there, so let's go there.
I'm actually glad you brought that up. I just learned about the everywhere search recently, and it's great. Basically what it is you, like, let's say you're trying to go from here in Bali back to Lisbon, where I'm going. What you do is you search for everywhere in the flights, and it'll show you kind of sorted by price all the places you can go, and you just keep scrolling until you get close, and then you do that last mile. Maybe it gets you to Barcelona, and then you do the last flight, some $45 Ryanair flight, and you're good.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. You get really cheap deals that way, so that's a good one.
Yeah.
All right, what is one piece of music or musical artist that speaks to you lately?
Well, as we're recording this, I just published episodes about searching for Sugar Man and the whole story about that. And that got me listening a lot to Rodriguez as well. I don't know if you know the guy.
I don't know him. I've seen the movie and it's amazing. Yeah,
and the music is just so amazing. And it's old. It's recorded in the early 70s, but it's still... it's still really, really good. But I listen to a lot. My musical taste, I kind of say that it starts with Earth, Wind and Fire and then just go from there. And I like a lot of the new stuff as well. So
Rodriguez, for the people listening, this guy is, I think, every bit as good as Bob Dylan. It just blew me away that he did not become more popular than he was.
Mm.
But this movie, not to spoil it, but he had a huge following in South Africa. And his producer,
he was a superstar.
He was a superstar. Yeah, like he was the
bigger,
Beatles,
of, bigger than Elvis.
Yeah, than any of those people. Everyone had his album, and he was like impoverished, living in Detroit or something. And his producer had hidden this fact from him. Yeah. And of course, now that the internet exists, it would be really hard for this type of thing to happen again.
And also, South Africa was very close to during apartheid.
Right, but this movie—if you have not seen it—Searching for Sugar Man. They put like his face on a milk crate or something, and they go and search like to find this guy because they just thought he had died, and sure enough, they find him living somewhere in Detroit, and then it's like the story of how he comes back and plays like 5 sold out shows to
in 98. And actually, when I heard about this story in 2013 when I was there the first time, and then the guy who told me the story, I was just, what? How come I have not heard of this? And then, there's a movie out, you should see it. And actually, he's going back on tour here in Cape Town in 2 weeks. I'm still here. Yeah, but it's probably sold out. So after that dinner, I went back to my room and started searching for this.
Sure.
Yeah, for the concert. And sure enough, all the concerts on that tour was completely sold out. But because they were sold out, they published an extra concert. That happened to be the first. They just started the tour earlier. And I think I was the first on the website. And without having heard a song, I bought the ticket, the best ticket I could find, which was center front row. In fact, my ticket was seat A1. So I went to a concert with Rodriguez and was a few feet away from him hearing this and watching the audience go crazy. Yeah, it was insane.
Yeah, just imagine the biggest superstar you can, and whatever that person is to South Africa, Rodriguez is more than that. So.
And then when I was one of the guys that found him was the owner of a small record vinyl record shop called Marby Vinyls, and his nickname is Sugar, named from the song. His real name is Siegerman, but people always called him Sugarman, and then it turned out to be Sugar, and now he's just Sugar. And in the episode that I just posted, I get to meet him. He invited me to his house, and we were sitting in his basement room and talking about the whole experience and what happened. So yeah, I got to meet Sugar Man.
We will link to that episode in the show notes so people can check it out. What important truth do very few people agree with you on?
The best thing I can come up with is that the world is not such a dangerous place as people tend to think. Again, going back to Cape Town, when I was going there the first time, a lot of people said, it's so dangerous, it's so dangerous. And I don't see that. Obviously, you need to have your common sense and not walk down a dark alley in the middle of the night, but that goes for most bigger cities around the world. I've been traveling to a lot of places, and as long as I bring my two favorite weapons, my common sense and my smile, it seems to go well so far. So a lot of people, they would probably disagree with me in that the world is not a dangerous place. And yeah, that's the best thing I can come up with.
No, I think that's a very true statement. And I think that I experienced that firsthand when I was in Colombia. A lot of my friends were saying, Pablo Escobar, it's so dangerous, all the drugs and guns and whatnot. And I found it just such the opposite.
Yeah.
Never felt safer.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Last question. If you had a time machine to go visit your 20-year-old Pablo Escobar self, what would you say to yourself?
When I was on Matt podcast, he also asked me that question, and can I give the same answer?
Sure.
I would say to myself, dude, that haircut is not doing you any favors.
Do you think you were handicapped by your haircut in radio?
That's
a great haircut for
that's,
radio.
That's why I went into radio and not TV. So yeah. So then I decided to cut it off.
Cool. All right. Well, Pale, anything else for listeners, people that are contemplating this crazy existence that we have, thinking about doing it themselves. Anything you'd want to say to them?
Take a decision and say it out loud, but be aware it's not for everybody. So don't be afraid if you start doing it and just think, this is not for me, I need a home base. Then you can stop or go slower. It's not for everybody, but if you're like me and you, you would love it, and just go out and do it, make it work.
Cool. All right. Well, where can I send people, Pali? What's the best website or social media, or how can people get in touch with you?
Well, my website's called The Radio Vagabond. That's also what theradiovagabond.com, and that's also what you search for when you search for the podcast. And remember the Radio Vagabond. Otherwise, you get the Danish version. I do two versions, and you probably want that. Don't want that. And then it's on all the different platforms. It's The Radio Vagabond as well.
Cool. All right, well, we'll link to the website, and then people can, I think you've got the subscribe links to the various platforms there, so we'll do that. Cool. Well, Pali, thank you so much. I'm glad we finally got to do this. It's
finally
been a long time coming.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right, cheers.
If you have a substantial social media following and consider yourself a micro-influencer in the digital nomad space, I invite you to check out a program I'm in the early stages of rolling out. I call it the Advocate Program for Nomad Podcast and Nomad Prep. It's a multi-level affiliate program that enables you to monetize the social media following you've built by referring my course to your followers. You can earn commission on both students you originate directly as well as students who come in via the advocates you originate, essentially a downline, and all through simply introducing your following of aspiring nomads to a course that can help them more confidently make the leap. I'm in the process of selecting a small group of early advocates who I'll be working with closely to refine this program and make it effective. In exchange for early participation, those influencers will be grandfathered in at the highest level of commission that will ever be offered in this program. To learn more about the program and the referral numbers necessary to generate a four-figure monthly side income, visit nomadprep.com/advocates and apply today. That URL again is nomadprep.com/advocates. Help aspiring nomads make the leap and get paid for doing so.
You've been listening to the Nomad Podcast. For links to all the resources mentioned in this episode, transcripts, show notes, photos, and more, visit nomadpodcast.com. Nomad Podcast is supported in part by Nomad Prep, an online academy to help aspiring digital nomads make a successful transition. Take the first 4 days free by visiting nomadprep.com/podcast.